There have been reports throughout the week of an increasingly violent police crackdown on protesters in Syria. Joining me now for an update on the situation today is Anthony Shadid, the Beirut bureau chief of the New York Times. I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi. It's a pleasure to join you.
Protest organizers have dubbed today a Friday of Rage. Are the protests bigger?
Well, it's hard to say if they're bigger. The breadth that we've seen on past Fridays seems to be about the same, perhaps even more. Organizers talk about protests in dozens of towns and cities across Syria. It was also bloody, as it's been on past Fridays, in particular in a southern town called Deraa, where we're receiving reports that hundreds, maybe even thousands of people had tried to march on the town, which is besieged by the military. They were seeking to break that siege. Security forces fired on them, and the latest we've heard is that perhaps 16 people were killed.
I was just talking to Brooke Allen about the fact that we haven't seen much protesting in Damascus and Aleppo, the two big cities. So is this mostly a small town phenomenon?
Well, I think that's a great question. And, people are watching whether these protests spread to Damascus and Aleppo. Now, we've had small protests there. Even today, there was reports of, some reports are saying thousands. I think it was much smaller than that. It's probably more like hundreds, quickly dispersed with tear gas. Unless you see really big protests in Damascus and Aleppo, I guess the thinking has gone so far, you're not going to see this uprising, gain a critical mass. You wonder, though, after the events of today, if that's still the case. I think what we saw today was the uprising gaining its own symbols in some ways, its own momentum, more, as much as a call for freedom or a call for the fall of President Assad's government, you're starting to see the protests organized around the people who have been killed so far, as many as, perhaps more than 450. I think the incident in Deraa today where these people were killed trying to march on the town, again, is going to create this imagery, this symbolism that in some ways is going to sustain the momentum of this uprising. So I think we're seeing a new dynamic at work that may shift some of the old kind of assessments of what where this might lead to.
There are estimates that about 450 people have died since the protests began in Deraa on March 15th. Which makes this one of the bloodiest crackdowns we've seen this year. And you were in Libya. We talked to you recently about your ordeal there. But is there any similarity here? The Tripoli has also been relatively free of protests in Libya.
It's hard to draw similarities. Although these are Arab countries, they're both Arab countries, obviously. They're countries with far, very different pasts, very different ideologies, very different governments. And governments that rely on, very different social bases to sustain their rule. I think most importantly in Libya, you had what the opposition would call liberated territory. In other words, the government's authority had crumbled in vast swaths of eastern Libya. That's not the case in Syria. This is a government that's still very much in charge of the country. The borders are very much in its hands. It's able to bar journalists from entering the country as it's done since this began. And I think the process to change or the process of change in that country is going to follow, perhaps a different roadmap. Even the most optimistic organizers and activists, while they'll talk about mass demonstrations overthrowing the government, I think a lot of people, when they talk more privately, seem to think that change may come within, that the minority religious sect that has in a lot of ways been in power in Syria since 1963, that change is going to come from within that sect, that they're going to try to perhaps push out the elite right now, create a new elite. There's so many scenarios out there of what might happen, but I don't think the Egypt model, the Tunisia model necessarily applies here.
Well, earlier this month, President Bashar al-Assad promised to end almost 50 years of emergency law, to act on unemployment, create what he called a more humble government. But that doesn't seem to have happened, and it doesn't seem to have been enough to end the protests.
Ostensibly, it was a huge step. The idea of lifting emergency rules, draconian emergency rule after almost five decades, that would have been seen as a huge victory by, I guess what we can broadly term the opposition, if it had happened before the uprising, began. It happened much later, and it happened amid a lot of killing and a lot of detentions. And right now, like you pointed out, we're talking about hundreds of deaths, thousands of detentions. At least on the ground, the lifting of emergency law has had little impact. In fact, at the beginning of the uprising, we saw the government try to offer a mix of concession and crackdown. At this point, this feels like crackdown, and it's getting bloodier and bloodier.
And talk about draconian. There were reports on NPR this morning that The police have been going house to house in Daraa, warning people that if they protest today, they won't see their children again. But since there are no foreign journalists in the area, it's impossible to confirm the story. Does that make it difficult to separate fact from rumor when you're reporting from Beirut or from Jordan?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the more frustrating stories that a lot of journalists have had to cover. You know, we're relying on secondhand reports. And, you know, while we see an uprising that has a lot of breadth, I mean, we see these protests happening from, you know, the Kurdish-dominated east to the Mediterranean coast to the, you know, the agricultural regions in southern Syria, we don't know the depth. And I think it's always very important to keep in mind that this is a government that still has bastions of support. It has minorities, religious minorities, Christians and heterodox Muslim sects who fear the day after of the fall of this government, who look across the border to Iraq, who look across the border to Lebanon. They see civil wars that have happened in both those countries, and there's fear of chaos. And so, you know, I think, you know, rather than kind of a simplistic, you know, model of Egypt or Tunisia, this thing hurtling toward the end of the government, we're probably going to see something that's more protracted, more complicated, perhaps even bloodier, and whose resolution might not be all that clear in the near term. There's a lot of forces at work, there's a lot of interest still at stake, and there's a lot of fear in that country, fear over sectarian bloodletting that I think is going to help shape the course that this country takes in the months ahead.
Well, Western governments have condemned the crackdown by President Bashar al-Assad's police forces, and the UN Human Rights Council is scheduled to meet today. But Syria has a lot of influence in the region. In Lebanon, it's home to many Iraqi refugees. It maintains friendly relations with Iran. Does that make diplomacy a bit more delicate to pull off?
And friendly relations with Turkey. I think Turkey is one country that definitely needs to be mentioned here. Turkey probably has, in some ways, more influence in Syria than any of its other neighbors.
And they've offered to come in and help work things out, haven't they?
Well, you wonder what they're really there for. I mean, I suspect they're there for to gauge how deep this uprising, you know, the depth of this uprising. Again, what everybody's trying to gauge at this point. There are steps short of the government's fall that could be taken. You know, whether it's some members of the government being pushed aside, whether, you know, there's a halfway point that might be reached. I think these are all part of the discussions going on right now, though it's hard to say with any authority what exactly is happening. But, you know, I think it's clear that the condemnations so far have been more rhetorical than effective. And this is terrain that is very familiar for the Syrian government. They've been there before. They've dealt with American sanctions. They've dealt with international condemnation. And they've managed to weather it until now. Now, this does feel different. This feels like the gravest challenge to the Assad family's rule, you know, four decades of rule yet. But where, you know, what role the international community plays is still pretty unclear. And I think I think those same fears that I spoke about of religious minorities in Syria, I think some of those fears are echoed by, you know, some of Syria's neighbors and even the United States. They wonder exactly, you know, what exactly would Syria look like if Ba'ath Party rule was to end, if President Bashar al-Assad was to fall.
Tony, after your ordeal in Libya, have things returned to normal in your life since you returned to Beirut?
Well, you know, it's been so busy since I've gotten back here and gotten back to work that it's kind of, I guess work is the best distraction, and I've managed to find plenty of work trying to get a sense of this story. And like I said earlier, it is a difficult story to cover. And it's also one of those stories that you know, you're always kind of second-guessing yourself as a journalist if you're getting it right, if you really understand what's going on, if you're being naive or gullible. And I think, you know, trying to wrestle with that is pretty much, you know, kept me busy.
Anthony Shadid is the Beirut Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Thanks for talking with us again.
My pleasure. Anytime.